Blog Talk Radio.
Feel fixed up. Up under the seat of my big black jacked up truck. Rolling on 35s. Pretty girl by my side. You got that suntan skirt and boots. Waiting on you to look my way and scoot. Your little hot self over here. Girl, hand me another beer. Just up a little catfish dinner. Gonna sound like a winner when I lay you down and love you right. Yeah, that's my kind of night. Might sit down on my diamond plate tailgate. Put in my country ride, hip-hop mixtape. Little Conway and little T-Pain. Might just make it rain. You can hang your t-shirt on a limb. Hit that bank and we can ease on in. Soak us up a little moonlight. You know I know what you like, yeah. All them other boys wanna wind you up and take you downtown. But you look like the kind that likes to take it way out. Out where the cornrows grow, roll, roll my boat. Floating down the Flint River. Just up a little catfish dinner. Gonna sound like a winner when I lay you down and love you right. Yeah, that's my kind of night. Yeah, that's my kind of night. My kind of, your kind of, this kind of night. We dance in the dark and your lips land on mine. Oh, gonna get our love on. Oh, time to get our buzz on. All them other boys wanna wind you up and take you downtown. But you look like the kind that likes to take it way out. Out where the cornrows grow, roll, roll my boat. Floating down the Flint River. Catch us up a little catfish dinner. Don't it sound like a winner when I lay you down and love you right. Kind of night. Yeah, that's my kind of night. That's my kind of night. Yeah, that's my kind of night. Come on.
Did snow. This is all. Did you feel the snow today?
It's bad, yeah.
It's like snow that you can't really shovel. Is that one?
Yeah. That.
Okay, you're good. Oh, you were. You were fine.
I was?
Yeah, you were fine.
Can't hear shit.
Well, don't worry about you.
All right.
No one's worried about what you hear.
I am.
I know. You're Terzo Jr. over there with, I need to hear myself.
I can't be able to hear myself.
Actually, you're too loud.
Really?
Yeah, you're too loud. Right. I have no one helping me today. So
Jesus.
It's just me and the soundboard and my life. Alan Spencer joining us a little later. Welcome to The Matthew Aaron Show, www.thematthewaronshow.com. That was Luke Bryan. That's my kind of night. I'm not having any of those kind of nights, so good for him. Fuck you.
Man.
He's making shitloads of money off that song, having those good times. Noodle salad.
Yeah.
Matthew Aaron Show, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter, Matthew Aaron Show on Facebook. You go to the search bar, type in The Matthew Aaron Show, click like. Stitcher, we're on there. iTunes, you can download us all the time on iTunes. I was pretty sure it was going to have to be a Mark Maron show today where I talked to myself, but Lee made it.
I made it.
The weather sucks.
I still made it.
We were just talking about the snow and how immediately when it fell, this wasn't snow that, like, anyone that knows me at all knows I hate snow, so I'll literally shovel it, like, 20 times just so I don't have to shovel a bunch of it at once.
Right. I'm like that, too.
This is snow that didn't matter if it was a quarter of an inch. It sticks to the ground.
Yeah,
and there's no shoveling it.
No, there's
not. Basically, I took a shovel to the driveway today, and I could not scoop up any snow. And I'm like, well, fuck this. Doing this. At least it's so flat and hard, though. It's not icy either, snow. It's not like icy snow either.
It's packed.
Mean, yeah, it's packed. This is the most compacted snow we've had.
Because it's that thing where it's that half wet snow that's melty, and then it got real cold, so it froze again. and now there's like fresh snow on top of it. So you think, oh, I can shovel that. But the, yeah, there's like maybe an inch or two of like light, soft, flaky snow, and then underneath is the packed stuff that softened and then refroze.
Yeah, that's exactly what the kind of snow it is.
Yeah.
And like, so I didn't know Lee was coming because
Lee Capreas,
no,
hello.
No,
at El Capreas, Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, get that out. That's very important.
It
for
is
all those
very
sponsors
important.
That you have and
yeah. Okay.
whatever you sponsor.
Steve Dahl Show, everybody.
Is that what you sponsor, Steve Dahl Show?
No, that's oh, whatever you whenever
you're
you
a,
say.
You're a true asshole.
Whenever you say that to your underlings.
Oh, my underlings.
Yeah.
Steve's actually nice to his underlings, so I take offense to that.
What about you?
I'm not nice to anybody.
No, well, how about he wasn't nice to you?
Oh, no, not me, because I wasn't an underling. I was like the scum at the bottom of the ocean.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't even recognize you at that point until you get on their shoe. Let's see. Fuck Steve Dahl. Fuck him. Fat fuck. I've just about had it.
That kind of show.
I've just, like, done.
Yeah.
I'm spent, man. I thought you weren't going to come, so I was literally planning on this. This was my plan. I was going to play the Luke Bryan song, and I was going to say congratulations for that. And then I was going to plug Spotify for like a minute. I figured that would waste good time, even though I don't get paid to plug Spotify. And then I thought I would talk about being a depressed fuck the last 24 hours because I just have no free time anymore.
Yeah.
And everyone's on my balls, and I feel like a bad person. You know, it's one of those things, too, where, like, you're so busy that when you don't get back to everyone or you don't call or they try to get a hold of you, you're an asshole, you're too good for them, blah, blah, blah. Okay, my priorities right now are as such.
Right.
Film, this TV deal I'm working on, which that's another thing that stresses me out because now this is a very famous Hollywood thing where even when... So, and I can't talk anything about it, but I'll talk in generality about it. When a company in Hollywood, this will be an eye-opener to all our students that listen. When a company in Hollywood wants your project, you know you read all the time on Deadline, Mike Fleming or whatever, and they'll be like, the project was so hot, they scooped it up right away, Warner Brothers. By hot and right away, they mean within 6 weeks.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I'm just being honest. This is the truth. People, I think, when they read this are like, oh, my God, this kid brought a script in the CAA.
He literally...
That day brought it to WB. Warner was like, this is hot. That day.
Yeah.
And they're like, make a deal in the room right now, motherfuckers. We need to have this.
Yeah.
No. They sit on this shit. They have to check with the lawyers. They have to see how much money they can spend. They have to... It's like a whole song and dance that goes... And this is if you have a great hot project.
Yeah.
It goes on for weeks.
Yeah. Like
negotiate back and forth to for their okay. When you get offered a deal by the WB, it takes them about a week or two to put a deal together, okay? For instance, this is a sample. This is not what's going on with me. It is in another company, but I'm not gonna name the company. But Warner Brothers will say, Lee, we love your script. Lee, we love your idea for a script. We want you to write it. This is hot. Don't take it anywhere else. We'll get back to you with our offer in 2 weeks. We got to take it to the lawyers. We got to take it to the business people, blah, blah, blah. Then your lawyer looks at it in 2 weeks and goes, okay. And you never, you know, I hate when people are like, yeah, call me. I don't have your fucking number. well, that would be a good start.
Uh-huh.
So anyways, then your lawyer's like, okay, Lee, they gave us their terms. Obviously, we're going to renegotiate. We're gonna play hardball here. And then you throw back your terms. 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
To do. About a week or two.
Right.
Yeah, because the lawyers got to put it all together, and they got other clients, and the WB has other movies going on. And it's just like they'll get to you when you're scheduled in the schedule thing.
Right.
Okay, 2 weeks goes by. Now, if they agree to your new terms, and there's no more renegotiating, which, by the way, will take another week, they will finally, maybe, send you over paperwork and pay you. Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. And this, by the way, is if your project is like the hottest shit going.
Right.
At minimum.
6 weeks.
4 to 6 weeks.
6 weeks. And, yeah, that's at the very best. Like, you think, like, oh, some development person is literally standing over you when you write the last word and print it, mm-hmm. and they snatch the page from the drive, and they're looking at it. It's beautiful. I love it. We'll give you a three-picture deal starting tomorrow.
Right.
And you're like, oh, gosh, golly, me?
You know what the funny thing is? You know the only place that happens? In the movie.
In the movie, yeah.
The one business where we're talking about what really happens, that's the biggest fallacy. That is like the business lying about the business.
It's JP
like,
wants
we need it now.
We need it now. JP wants you in his office by Thursday.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Never happens.
Yeah.
Never happens. All those stories Robert Evans tells where he's like, and I was on the lot the next day.
Yeah.
No, he wasn't. He was there in like 4 weeks.
Four weeks.
But in Robert Evans' Hollywood land, that's like the next day.
Well, he was, you know, he took in a few substances, and then 4 weeks became the next day.
That's right. That's the other thing.
Time flies.
So it is by far the slowest business ever. So
on
I'm
Lutes.
Waiting for this deal to happen. So that's another thing. Waiting is the hardest part, they say. And then everyone's like, well, don't just wait. Do another project. I have three projects going on.
Right.
I don't want to do another project.
Right.
I'm good on projects. I'm good. We shoot in 26 days, 27 days.
Wow.
Literally.
Cool.
Shooting 27 some days, okay? So that project's greenlit. That's going. It's moving, okay? So now I literally can't do anything money-wise because daddy's got to pay the bills,
uh-huh.
okay? Money-wise, I cannot do anything till my other project goes through. So you just sit and you wait. And you wait, and you wait. I wonder if Tom Petty's song, Waiting is the Hardest Part,
was about the business.
Some bullshit thing in the business. It sounds like some Joe Walsh would write to.
Right.
Like, totally, they hate the music business, the business side of it.
Right.
And I got to imagine that song had to be about money.
Yeah. There's so much, you know, there's so much that you see that's about waiting, you know.
Everyone thinks those kind of songs are about love. No. They're about money.
Money.
There's no such thing as love. Get over it. It's about money.
Yeah.
It's the love of money.
Yeah. Love of money.
When's my check coming?
Right.
And so now I'm just sitting around, and this is a funny thing. I mean, I do have to still put together a shot list for the film.
Uh-huh.
And we got to finish up locations. It's all a bunch of, like, little things.
That are important.
Spread out. They're all important.
Yeah.
They're all important. Like, you got to go lock down cigars for me still.
Yeah. Going later.
You're going to go tonight?
Yeah.
In this shit storm?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to be wrapping up early. We're not going to do anything after Alan's on.
Right.
I'm not in the mood. And
okay.
It's shitty out, and I want to leave.
You want to go with?
Yeah, I'm just going to be honest. I don't know if I'm going to go with yet. I may go to the gym again.
Okay. Again?
It's crunch time.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been going twice a day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's crunch time.
Well, how much more do you need to lose weight?
Or not about losing weight.
Own more? You look,
yeah, I don't
you're
know.
Fine.
I don't know. No. I just don't want to have any excuses. I don't want to look back in a year. Because, by the way, in a year, I'll even be in better shape. So I don't want to look back in a year and be like, when this premieres at Sundance or Slam Dance or Cannes or the Berlin Film Festival or my mom's basement.
Right.
Whatever the fuck it premieres.
Dance.
I don't want to look back and go, I could have done more for this film. I need to be, to myself, thinking I did as much as I could.
Right.
At every point in time.
Now, I already know the answer to this question, but if you're waiting so much, explain to our audience why you don't have any time to yourself.
Well, I don't have any time because I got this film going on.
Right.
All right, so I got to go to the gym twice a day. I got the film going on. I talked to Pat Wimp today. I had other meetings today. You know, I love our cast. Our cast is amazing, but Kyan stayed with me all last week, which was great. He's outstanding. I love him. He's a great guy.
But you had to entertain him.
But now I got to be a house guest. You know, I got a house guest, too. And I love him, and I love him being here. I'm very torn because I loved having someone here to, like, hang out with and talk to and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But I'm very happy he's gone because then I could go back to work.
Right.
But then I was kind of like, I'm very torn about it.
And then you're like, hello?
Yeah, right. And then, you know, I came back home to save some money and blah, blah, blah. And that's the other thing. I'm waiting for this check on this TV deal so I can go get an apartment. And, you know, it's just, you can't say no to your ma. And, like, every 30 minutes I have something she wants me to do around here. I literally don't have, like, a minute to breathe. And then all my friends and everybody are like, you don't call, you don't text, you don't write, you don't come see me, you don't drive to the city every fucking day to see me. I don't have fucking time. I don't have time. I don't have time to get
which
laid.
Which circle of friends? Your primary?
Everybody.
Your second?
Everyone,
your tertiary circle?
The only people that truly understand are you, who's been very patient. Caesar, who's been incredibly patient.
Yeah.
Shockingly. I love Caesar for it. By the way,
well,
I
we
also
know,
did want to say...
Caesar and I, we lived with you. We know
right.
how busy shit gets.
We're going to talk about
we
this.
We lived in California.
We're going to talk about this in a minute. But I did want to give Caesar and Tobias some props for something in a minute. But Lenny's very understanding. Lenny's very, you just need to work, and
yeah.
concentrate and focus. Same with Anthony. Mikey's very understanding. So I guess my close friends are understanding.
Right.
It's the people that lived in Chicago that I wasn't totally friends with when I was in L.A., and they don't really understand this life, this
right.
L.A. life that I've brought back with me.
Right.
They don't get it. They don't get it. So it's a very much, I'm not doing enough for people. And this is something else I wanted to talk about. Do you ever feel like, and this is where I was going to bring up Caesar and Pat, they work so hard on this show and expect nothing in return, okay? And so do you. And you know, I'm so grateful.
Yeah.
Outside of three of you and Lenny and Anthony and Mikey and Alex, okay, and Chuck, that list, okay, that list of people. Outside of those guys, do you ever feel like all everyone wants is to take from you and no one ever does anything for you?
Yeah.
Like, they all want something from you.
Right.
But you never get anything back.
Right. And it's not always, like, money or influence. They want your time.
I'll give you a great example.
Your time, which is the most precious thing.
Right. And this is where I was going to combine the two topics.
And it's not something you don't want to give them. You'd like to see them, but
right.
you can't.
Everybody wants to hang out, right?
Uh-huh.
On their schedule.
On their terms.
When I fucking text someone, when I have this fucking 2 hours of breathing room, and I want to go do something, and I fucking text someone, I don't even get a text back.
Right.
I don't even get a text back.
No,
like
neither do I.
Like, go fuck yourself. I'll hang out with you on my time. Blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I didn't hang out all weekend, again. I didn't go out at all. I haven't been going out a lot. There'll be, like, random moments, like on a Tuesday night at 11 p.m. where I can finally, like, go do something for, like,
yeah.
an hour or
uh-huh.
2 hours at a local bar. Or I'll even drive downtown if the weather's fine. For what? 2 hours. Whatever, right? Nobody's around. But I know they're all out drinking and shit.
Yeah.
I know they're all partying.
Right.
No one's around. I'm not talking about Lenny and them again. I'm talking about my outer-tier friend that don't know the L.A. side of life.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of annoys me. It's like, so I get this. I'm only a bad friend because I'm not jumping to when you want me to jump.
Right.
But when I try to say, hey, I'm really busy, but now I can do something with you.
You're still making time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they don't count that, by the way. I've ran into so many people who are like, you never hang out. I'm like, I hit you up a couple of nights ago. I know it was 11 p.m., but, I mean, that's all I had.
Right.
And they're like, I didn't get it.
Yeah,
they didn't get the text, or, oh, they don't remember. Or,
right.
I'm like, what is with people? They really don't give a fuck.
Right.
By the way, this whole idea that L.A. is full of all these selfish people, I have noticed a genuine jealousy and dislike of Hollywood from Chicagoans.
Right.
That I really don't understand, and I'll tell you why. Moving back from here to there, you know what the only difference has been? Weather.
Weather.
That's it.
Same thing.
People work harder here. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
People-wise? No, you're just as selfish.
No, they're dicks.
You're just as superficial.
Self-absorbed.
You're just as self-absorbed.
Yeah.
You're just as jealous. You're
yep.
just... There's really no difference.
Spiteful.
Zero.
Right.
Zero. I'm not even kidding. There's actually...
Well...
There's even a little more spite here than there.
Well, yeah. But that's that coiled... That's that Midwest mentality. They're very arrogant. They're arrogant here in a different way because they're arrogant. Arrogance in Hollywood is like, I know all these people. I'm so cool. I
yeah.
have so much clout. I can get you. Arrogance here is like, I'm the smartest person in this room. It's a intellectually driven arrogance.
And you know
what?
But
I'll tell you something about me specifically. Is
I
have,
think Alan's calling.
I have a blue-collar job, and people come in, and they're regular people, and I go to packing houses, and I deal with union guys who are daily guys, and they're nice. I'm with, like,
sure.
I do mingle with
common
folk.
Yeah. You know what it is? I hate to say this, because this is going to sound really bad. It's white people.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. There is a pretension in the white community in Chicago that is so unbelievable. Like I
get it. It's great being white.
Yeah, but they're on their high horse, man. I mean, I'm not saying it's a white, black, Mexican thing.
No.
I'm saying is Latinos, I have no problem. They have no ego around me.
No.
Black people don't have an ego around me.
No.
For whatever reason, the majority of people I bump into who think they're bigger than life, that are like high society, arrogant motherfuckers, are all Northwest suburb white people.
Yeah. Well, I tried
calling. Is that crazy?
I called you the first few weeks when I got back, and then I got the message.
Yeah, you realize I'm
I got
like,
the message.
Done.
Yeah.
I do owe you a call, though. But I think Alan's on the phone.
All right.
Hold on. We'll see who's on the phone.
What do you think about white people, Alan?
Hello.
Hello. How are you guys?
Oh, Alan. How you doing?
Hey.
what do I think of white people, Caucasians?
Yeah, what do you think of the Caucasians?
In big cities, we mean. Because it's a broad...
Look, I really am a proponent of Soylent Green. So... they have good taste. I don't think of myself as a white person. I mean, I'm half Jewish and everything. But I think anybody that's offbeat... You know what? Anybody that can conjugate a verb is a minority in this country. So I feel like I'm a minority, and I, listening to you guys, you're minorities too. So
yeah. Thank you, Alan. I take that as a compliment.
Well,
you're
a you're a writer, and writers aren't white people. They're something else.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
I don't know what that means, but it sounded great.
The bottom class of show business. Yeah, so we're waiters. But we're the waiters of show business. We come and we take orders and we write things down, but we spit in the food.
I want to let everyone know Bullet in the Face is now out on DVD, and it's been presented by Shout Factory, and it's the complete series. It was a 6-part series that was on IFC, and we're going to get to all this, but it's definitely a must buy, especially if you're a fan of Alan Spencer. By the way, it's a great title cover on the DVD. And Alan does some commentary on there. I mean, the artwork on this show was phenomenal, top to bottom, from the cinematography. I know the kind of budget Alan had to deal with here, too. And let me tell you something. I know he's a comedy writer and a comedy director. I mean, I know Alan's known for comedy. But this guy put together a production on a minimal budget that looks nothing less than like a Michael Bay style film. It looks that good. It
really
looks like that kind of money. Well, you saw Bullet in the Face. It looked that good.
Yeah.
Alan, is that crazy of me to say? Of course you're going to say no, because I just
kind of... No, I used every trick in the book. No, I used every trick in the book to put the money on the screen, because there wasn't much, and it was the Canadian dollar, so that translates a little bit differently. But I knew going in, you know, I write to the budget. I realize, you know, what we have. For example, Eddie Izzard playing the crime lord named Tannhauser, you know, he's agoraphobic in it. Some people call it agoraphobic. It's agoraphobic. You can use either one. But so he's an agoraphobe, and he spends all his scenes, you know, obviously not going outdoors. And when I met with Eddie Izzard, he said, that's very interesting for the character. Why did you make him agoraphobic? And I said, so I could shoot you in 5 days.
Yeah, right. I was going to ask you that. Is that on purpose? Did you know the budget before you knew what the show was even? Did you know you had a budget before you wrote the show?
Well, I knew it would be low budget because of the network, and the network was talking about certainly the budget. You know, and I realized in talking to the network would, you know, call me collect, so that would give me a clue. But I knew going in, you know, what's most important about it, though, my friend, is there's the budget and there's the shooting schedule. So they kind of go hand in hand. So you look how many days you have to shoot, and that's how you kind of deal with it. And then I wrote it to certainly that, because we were going straight to series. We weren't doing a pilot. So I was thinking to myself, okay, here's an interrogation room. I was making sure to try to use it in every episode because we'd be shooting all those scenes in the same day. So I was repeating sets a lot. So I was very, very conscious of that and trying to maximize when I could put action in there. And because it was a tight schedule, things went wrong, and I had to rewrite on the set, and I had to ride herd on it certainly a lot more. There were some people that had never done this kind of thing before, and I had done a half-hour action comedy. There really haven't been that many half hours with you know, violence in them. I mean, aside from Two and a Half Men, but that's off screen. But you know, so you know, and it, so it was ambitious in that regard. But you know, it all kind of came together, and we shot it like a low-budget movie. But I'm happy that that you feel it looked that good. I'll let you know a trade secret I didn't know. You know, there's a fictitious city in it called Brutville.
Yes,
and that was from a failed project, the CGI we used. They worked on it, and we did it up, but they already had the wireframes. They already had a digital city for something else. So I looked at that, and I said, let me use it for this. So,
oh, that's great. Man, that's great, because that's one of the things I was going to reference. The city looks fantastic.
Secondhand,
on that budget.
Secondhand CGI.
Well, I'll tell you what else Alan did that's really smart, for, and this is for all writers out there. When you got anything that's a low-budget affair, He used very minimal set pieces. Like, he had a few places where this took place. But the way he wrote it made it feel like that's because it all takes place in that world, in this world of these, like, 6-7 locations. That's the world these characters live in. So it actually works out really well in that regard.
I'm glad you feel that way because, I mean, there's a spoof miniseries, I think, that's running now. That is a low budget as well, and they make jokes about the budget. They show phony miniatures and phony rear projection and model cars and things like that. And see, I think that's a mistake because that destroys your verisimilitude. I did a really cool interview with the AV Club. I was really honored to get tapped you do imaginary programming. If you had 24 hours, what you would put on the TV. And I referenced Young Frankenstein for not being... It's called a parody. It's called a spoof, a parody. It, to me, it isn't. It's just a legitimate Frankenstein movie that happens to be funny.
Yeah,
right.
You know, it's shot brilliantly. The performances are all great. It's not an extended sketch. So that's what I was going for in this, to take it seriously. And that's what was funny in shooting in Canada, where a lot of the crew also spoke French. That was their...
Yeah.
So you would have laughed because there were a few times they would come up to me with a French accent going, excuse me, this is a drama, right? Because they shouldn't say that. This is a drama. I said, yeah.
Yes, whatever you want it to be. Whatever
we'll,
you want
we'll
it
laugh
to
at
be,
it
pal.
And we will call it comedy.
Well, there was a reference to Iraq in there. There was a wisecrack about Iraq, invading Iraq, and one of the girl in the crew came up and she goes, "This is not for Fox, is it?" I said, "No, it isn't."
Let me ask you something, Alan. I don't want to get too off topic, but I know since you're such an avid Mel Brooks fan and a friend, and that you know Mel, here's the question I have for you about, because you brought up Young Frankenstein. Why is it outside of, I mean, I get Spaceballs, but outside of Spaceballs, everyone characterizes his films as spoofs, when really they're not. I think you brought up a very interesting point about Young Frankenstein. A lot of his films are not spoofs.
No.
But they're considered that. Why is that? Do you know when that started? Was that in the 70s when Mel was really hitting it?
Yeah, exactly. His first film was a short subject called The Critic, actually, if you want to, you know, be that anal retentive about it. But The Producers is obviously not a spoof. It's a comedy. It's a farce. And The 12 Chairs, once again, that's based on a Russian novel, and that's a farce as well. And I think it's because Blazing Saddles was his first official hit, first box office hit. I don't actually call that a spoof or parody. I call it a satire because it has teeth to it.
I think
the connection, both Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein came out in the same year, 1974. So that was really, you know, he was the MVP of comedy. I mean, that was hitting pretty hard to have both those big hits in the same year. And if you think about it, I think the reason it got grafted on him so heavily This is my own theory, is because the only thing the public knew about Mel Brooks when Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein hit was his best-known credit before then, irrespective of the 2,000-year-old man. His best-known credit before then that they recognized was Get Smart.
Yeah, right.
So, which is a spoof, which is a parody, even though it transcends it. So I think the ball of wax of Get Smart to Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein turned him into the parody king, and then he was following that up with High Anxiety, which is a Hitchcock parody. So I think that's what happened. The power of those movies, you know.
This whole
spoof thing didn't really start till like Airplane. I think
probably that was when it hit really big.
Yeah.
This is why Alan and I are good friends, though, and I love Alan. He is like comedy history. Like he knows all the history of comedy. I love it. So that's interesting about Mel, but I wanted to talk about you. How much were you influenced by Mel? I know we've talked about this before, but you brought up Get Smart, and I feel like that's a show that you probably were very highly influenced by.
Oh, big time. I was under the influence. Big time. I said it all the time. You know what I got angry about here? I read on some message board where I was giving an interview, and they said, I'm a fan of Alan Spencer, but he tells the same story about Andy Kaufman, the same stories. I go, well, those are the only stories I've got. You want me to make some up? Like, I hate people. But I've said this before, you know, I was a latchkey kid. My parents worked nights. And because of that, I didn't have dinner sitting around the table with a family. I didn't have brothers or sisters either. You know, I would make TV dinners for myself and you know, and that was very exciting. And so spending a lot of time by yourself, when you look at TV, you look for things that are either take you out of your life or a reflection of your life. And nothing reflected my life on television. I mean, Father Knows Best, that could have been introduced by Rod Serling for where I'm coming from. I couldn't relate to that. But Maxwell Smart lived alone and got into mischief and adventures and screwed up a lot, and people were yelling at him. And I kind of related to that. So believe it or not, I mean, Get Smart, which was considered in the day to be outre and avant-garde and crazy and outside the norm, that was a normal sitcom to me. That's what I thought a sitcom was.
I'm with you. When I grew up, it was Get Smart, and the other show I loved was The Munsters. And the reason I loved the shows where Maxwell Smart and Herman Munster never knew they were screwing up, though.
No.
They always thought they were doing the right thing.
Never did it.
I always felt like that. I always felt like that kid that would try to do something and I'd fuck it up.
But that's the funniest thing there is.
Yeah.
Is to me in the world, is just that person who just never gets it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, Inspector Clouseau was that way, too. I mean, Edwards once said that Inspector Clouseau was actually Don Quixote.
Right.
You know, tilting at windmills and everything like that. But that was the thing that was great about Maxwell Smart was that he wasn't a nebbish. They do a lot of the parodies, and they'll do a nerdy and nebbishy character. He was unapologetic. He was a cool-looking guy. He drank martinis, he smoked cigarettes, and he viewed himself as the world's greatest spy. And that was great. When he did his fight scenes and the action, he meant business, and that was also partly, I think, called from the fact that Don Adams himself, which a lot of people still don't know, was a Marine. He fought in World War II.
Yeah.
So when he handled weapons, like automatic weapons and things like that, it was second nature to him. So the action scenes meant business. So that stayed with me, too, when you talk about it as an influence, because some of the violence in Get Smart was pretty real. I mean, people were getting killed. There's one episode where somebody gets harpooned just like out of Thunderball. So that also assimilated itself in my mind, that the sitcom form that I was interested in had a lot of shootings and stabbings and mayhem. So that really screwed me up. But it seems to have made a nice living for me.
Well, anyone that saw Bullet in the Face can kind of see that there's some influence to Get Smart, like on crack,
right,
when it comes to it. But
there aren't too many sitcoms where people get harpooned anymore.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No, but maybe we're missing that. We're missing that. So I want to ask you, Alan, let's get serious for a minute about something. Okay. I love you. So this is, don't get mad at me. But one common things I hear when it comes to you is that you're a creative genius but you're difficult. Do you hear this often, and what is your response when you hear that?
That I'm not mediocre.
Right.
So I don't, you know, I don't know. I mean, I do things that are, it's you know what? It's hard to be easygoing if you're doing something very, very different. Different and difficult tend to go together sometimes. I'm not always difficult. I've been put in some difficult situations, I would think, but that's not my imperative.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess, that was kind of where I'm going is it so much that you're difficult or you've been in difficult situations?
Or,
and because you know how the Hollywood gossip mill works. When someone works with someone and maybe they put them through the ringer, they feel like they were put through the ringer too. And maybe Alan Spencer's not a big gossipy type, so he's not going around saying this person put me through the ringer, that person put me through the ringer. But the other person is, so it makes you appear difficult.
Or is difficult just the term ascribed to people who, you know, want their work to not be turned into mush?
Yeah, that's part two.
Well, yeah, I mean, any of the work, look, you're talking about Mel Brooks, the studio, first of all, Get Smart, when it was tested, the network said, make Don Adams stop doing that annoying voice. You know, that's the research there. I mean, when Blazing Saddles was shown to the executives, it got stony silence, and they were actually talking about not releasing it. So anytime you deal with things like that, anything that's different, I'm not putting my stuff on par with that, you don't just roll over all the time. Sledgehammer was developed at HBO as a series at one point, and they wanted a comedian in the lead, and I wanted the actor that eventually paid it at ABC. So the fact that I was saying no to the bizarre suggestions of Rodney Dangerfield or Joe Piscopo, no, that's what they were saying. I mean, does that make me difficult? Those were bad ideas. But, you know,
if they threw Joe Piscopo at you, God bless you for your difficulty.
Well, but then the show turns out well and is well received, and then people seem not to remember those things that they were saying, you know. But I haven't had the difficult rep in a very, very long time. I probably maybe have some of it on this because this was a problematic production, and I was trying to keep everything harmonious on it, you know?
I know you were. I know you were because I could tell. But I wanted to bring up Hexed, a film you did a while ago. What was the difficulties with that? It seemed like it didn't get a proper release, or I don't know what the deal was, but what was what is the background to Hexed?
Oh, that was just that was a regime change. So
yeah.
The person.
So it happened after you filmed it. They changed the regime or during it?
Almost right on the verge. It was like 2 weeks before. They're going to roll it. A few weeks before we're going to roll it, there was a regime change, and because they had a relationship at the studio then with the late Bernie Brillstein, because he was an exec producer on it, who was very powerful and a wonderful person and protective. They didn't want to pull the plug necessarily on the movie. He wanted to keep it going, but what they did is they slashed the budget and the schedule literally right before we were supposed to shoot, and because I had a low budget, you know, that would have derailed it anyhow, and maybe they thought we'd say we can't do it or walk away, say we can't do it for that, because many people have it in the past. They'll say they slash the budget and they say I can't make it for that. But because of my experience on TV, I went ahead and did it and made the schedule, which surprised them. So, you know, I never have great amount of resources for what I do, and so I'm just sort of used to it. And when you mention that about the bullet in the face, you know, I'm just not used to ever having a big budget. So
yeah, no, I think that's fascinating, because that used to happen in the '90s a lot. By the way, for our film student listeners listening, or anyone that's under the age of like 30 that doesn't know about film,
no,
is in the '90s and '80s. there were a lot of regime changes at the studios, which doesn't really make a difference anymore because they're all corporations now.
Right.
So basically, everything that happens is going to happen no matter who's in charge. They all have the same – the game plan will continue
right.
no matter who gets fired.
Many, many people are placeholders.
In the 90s and 80s, regimes would change, vice presidents, presidents, whoever's in charge, and then all of a sudden someone new would come in and say, yeah, this film that's supposed to go in 2 weeks, we're cutting it. And so that is something that happened with Hex Tier, and that's what I want our listeners to understand, is this happened a lot in the 80s and 90s. A lot of films ended up getting hacked when someone else new came in.
That's really the case. But, you know, when you talk about that stuff, it's I think every, you know, artist at some point is going to be difficult because there's only so much play acting that you can do, because most situations are difficult to get into because it's you know, creativity and egos and things like that. And you really do try to get along, but, you know, the whole, you know, mantle of difficult comes from situations that are made difficult and how you certainly handle them. And I think any time you're dealing with anything that's different and doesn't have a lot of money and new people, because there's some people that are inexperienced that come into these things, it's kind of a mix. But, you know, you have to look and see. The thing is, you have to look and see who says you're difficult and who says that they had a good time with you. And invariably, you know, the people that have a good time with you tend to be the other artists and the people you keep working with. And those are the ones you have a history with. Because if you're really, truly difficult, you don't keep working.
Well, let's talk about Bullet in the Face, because this is a show. All right. Now, we had you on around August 16th when it premiered last year. I remember it was around – I think it was my birthday we had Alan on.
Right.
And we were talking about, wow, this is – what a great show, blah, blah, blah. I wonder how the ratings are going to be. Okay, days later go by, and here I am, and I discover the ratings are some of the highest ratings IFC's had in years. Right. However, not publicized.
Right.
Why? Why was it not publicized at all, how the ratings were really good for the show?
Yeah, they went up, and then it was the Canadian production company said they had some difficulty getting exactly what the ratings were, because, you know, they – you know, the thing about ratings now, which is fascinating, is back in the day, you'd call a number afterwards. There was a number you could get. And when I was at ABC, I was able to get that number because I was dating somebody at the network. And so that was helpful. But
real sly. I like that.
Your ratings.
Yeah, it was great. You know, yeah, she was great because she would be there in the morning when I call it. But, you know, but so there was a number you would call, and you would hear the overnights, and it would be a recording. And you would hear, you know, 8 o'clock, 8:30, this, and it would be the networks. And there were only three networks. And you would hear the numbers. And that would be the rating. I mean, that would be that was your number. And Sledgehammer, they were good because they were going up the next week. And so that was, a thrill. And that was a reflection of people liking what they were seeing. Now, there's a whole other formula. I could take any number. You could take any show on the air right now, and through the looking glass, through the prism of this bizarre new calculus, and especially with the disparity between cable and network, I could make a show. You could say anything is a hit, and that's what you hear. You hear, like, we're this in demo 18 to 49. We're this or that. And then they add in, you know, live plus 7. Live plus 6, you know, DVR viewing.
Yeah.
So technically, anybody can say something is high rated or something is just middling, whatever. They can say whatever they want through this kind of the looking glass because of this new formula. Because the truth is most cable ratings, with few exceptions, are abysmal when you compare it to the level of viewers available and what a network gets. I mean, a network's low-rated show versus a cable's low-rated show. For a cable, that could be a high-rated show, but on a network, it's a low-rated show. And, I mean, back in the day, Sledgehammer, one of our lowest-rated episodes is 17 million viewers. Today, they would be building an altar to me with that.
Yeah. You'd be the number two or three show on television with 17 million right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the truth of the matter is, if you're getting really high ratings, good, bad, or indifferent, whether you like the show or not, you hear about it. You hear
yep.
about it. If somebody's getting really high ratings, you hear about The Walking Dead and all those sort of things, getting record ratings. And when people don't release their ratings, you know, and there are a lot of new upstart cable channels that come out there, and they don't, they make it a policy not to release their ratings. And there's a certain threshold of ratings that don't get listed really for public view, because if they're beneath them, a million maybe, I don't know what the...
No, I think it's 100,000 or 200,000 or something.
Yeah, if there's a certain level, they don't even report them.
Right.
So, they won't, you know, they launch new cable channels and everything all the time, and they don't put the ratings out there, because the truth is, if the general public heard it, it would be horrific. I was shocked how low some of the ratings are for shows that are on there that they quote-unquote call hits. But, you know, that's the whole thing. That's the whole thing, though. You know what? Anything is a hit. Anything that's not an official big hit is a cult hit.
It's a cult hit. Like Girls.
It's a niche.
Everyone says how big Girls is, but you look at their ratings, and they're some of the lowest on HBO. And, like, you're like, how's this show a hit?
See, I don't know what the ratings are for that. I was thinking more the basic cable things where my jaw dropped about, you know, some of the numbers there. I remember asking once, what do you consider a hit show? What's a good rating? And then I heard something like 200,000 viewers, and I went, you're kidding. And then
that was at IFC?
I won't say where. You know,
okay.
But, you know, you could probably guess. No, but
yeah.
you know, so it's a little surprising just to see what the nightly ratings are. But, you know, look, I mean, some of these cable channels are just rare. Through the Monday through Friday, they're not even airing originals. They're airing, you know, umpteenth reruns of something. And the thresholds are really low. But, you know, you can tell by the sponsors. You can kind of tell what a network is, certainly by the sponsors, by the commercials coming in. So, you know, when I'm watching a show and then it cuts to a VHS recorded commercial of a plumber who says he's willing to work for free or for food or tips, you know.
When you see Eagle Man.
Alan
doesn't come to Chicago. He doesn't know the Eagle Man.
No, but I've seen that commercial. That's a famous commercial. I know. I'm hip. I'm versed on your coast. I mean, I love the Eagle.
Here's the thing. He
knows Al Pamani. He knows Victory Auto Records.
I bet you Alan knows Svengoolie, too.
Svengoolie, Bob Roorman.
Yeah, Svengoolie apparently did a song about Tracy Scoggins. She was in a movie where she was playing a hot chick, an alien disguised as a hot chick, and it was killing guys. And then Svengoolie did a song saying, to survive, you got to kill Tracy Scoggins. So apparently she's recording a song about going after Svengoolie, so that's an inside tip, I'm telling you.
I love Svengoolie.
Rich goes,
yeah.
The famous commercials when he laid an egg, right? Did he do that?
Yeah, he jumps on the car and lays an egg. Yeah.
The women shield their eyes.
Yeah.
And out come the rates.
And let me ask you, Alan, then, let's stick with what happened here, though, with the release. Okay, so the release comes. All right, they don't tout your numbers, even though they're really good. Then you're hearing rumblings. Not you, I'm talking about, I'm just saying, the proverbial we hear rumblings. At least at our show, I know that we heard rumblings, that there was trouble during production, that there was trouble all along, and that IFC didn't really want to tout the success of this show. How much of that is true, and what can you clear up about that?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, well, the fact that it aired all six episodes over two nights tells me that, I mean, that's total confidence. But, you know?
I think they were surprised.
I think, you know what the thing is, what happened with this? You know, I'll be diplomatic as possible. It was never shown to an audience. This is the first time I've done a show where usually what I was expecting, your day in court comes when you put it in front of a crowd, because an audience ultimately decides what works and what doesn't, what's funny and what isn't. They give thumbs up or thumbs down, and that's what everybody lives by. But without that, and that's what obvious, that's what's happened with, that's what saved Blazing Saddles. That's, you know, it was previewed. it was previewed for an audience after the executives didn't dig it, and then they were shocked at what happened. It's obviously what happened with Get Smart. They said, the network said, don't do that voice, and everybody was imitating it the next day. And in Sledgehammer, which the ABC executives were really great to deal with. They were very into the auteur theory, very supportive, and very confident. And they were also willing to roll the dice, which is key. They were not risk adverse. They knew that they were taking a shot with something, but they, when they did, they decided, let's go all the way. But when they had some things they weren't sure about in the Sledgehammer pilot, they just said, let's put this in front of an audience. And when it was put up in front of an audience and he blew up a building using a Lars rocket, he blew up an entire building to get one sniper on the rooftop, and the audience roared and applauded, the network was their fears were put at ease because they heard the audience laughing at it. Now, this show never was shown to an audience. The only time they got the audience response was when it aired, which was good. But then I think they were surprised with it. The thing I heard was that they thought the audience wouldn't stick with the show, and they dug it and they wanted more, and Twitter exploded and all that stuff. But that was the only time it was given the litmus test of an audience. But then, look, conversely, I'll speak freely because we're amongst friends. They got fully behind an animated show that did nothing.
Yeah.
And it's not coming out on DVD, or at least yet. I don't know if it will. But, this is coming out on DVD. It's already sold out on Amazon the first day. And a lot of people are reviewing it for the first time, wondering where it's been.
Yeah, no, I've seen those. I've seen those. You've been doing a lot of press, and Shout does a great job with these releases. Shout is amazing,
Shout is
by
good.
The way. They sent me the whole series of Friday. They sent me the, Fridays on ABC. It used to be on ABC with Michael Richards.
Yeah.
Andy Kaufman was on one famous episode.
They made
a
show with Ice Cube. And
No. But they also sent me a whole Richard Pryor collection, tons of stuff. I love Shout, okay?
Yeah, Shout's good.
Send me all the shit you got. But
wait, Swag? You got it for free?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
well,
man.
I shouldn't say that. I love Shout.
Okay.
Just put it that way.
All right.
I love Shout.
I see.
But Bullet in the Face, when I found out Shout picking them up, I go, what a perfect place to be. They're going to do the exact opposite of IFC, where IFC, in my view, I have friends at IFC, so I'm not trying to say anything too bad, but let's be honest. They tried to dump the show. All six episodes in two nights. It still did good ratings. It still has a cult following. And Shout's going to take care of this show, and it's going to sell. They're going to sell these DVDs.
It already is. And,
yeah.
Look, to their credit, IFC ordered this straight to series. It was a rough production. It wasn't a lot of money. It was Canadian, so they had to hire all Canadian people that don't do things for in the States or know how that kind of works and the show business kind of liaisons and things that you do there. They hired a director. The director was the network's choice, and he didn't have a comedy background. They hired him because they wanted to have a look, which you're complimentary about, and he was also good with action. But he had no clue about comedy, and the first day on the set, and they said, well, you're there for the comedy. And I said, okay. But I said, it's a little difficult to usurp a director. You got to be careful. But first day he says to me, I'm a funny guy. And I said, well, excuse me? He said, I'm a funny guy. And then if you had a camera on me, my expression, it would have gotten laughs. And then he started to do a dance to show it to me he was funny. He goes, I'm a funny guy. And he started doing a little dance, and he kind of did break dance and everything. And it was My face looked like Oscar Schindler at that moment.
He did that thing where he pretended to be moving part of his finger off of his thumb. See? You ever seen that?
No, he wasn't that sophisticated. But one of the notes I got was, can you make the directors stop directing the actors? So, that's not an easy note.
Not an easy note.
I'm difficult. I got it done. I did what needed to be done, and it is an unusual show, so it's good that they did make it. But the problem is if you're going to do something out there, if you're, that's the thing that ABC that did was correct, because, you know, I was a kid in my early 20s coming in there. I hadn't done a show before. It was my first pilot. I hadn't produced a show. The term showrunner hadn't been invented yet, but, you know, I also wasn't that. But the executive there named Stu Bloomberg said, if you're going to do something this unusual and this out there, you got to go all the way with it and back the guy that you're whose script that you're doing.
Sure.
And that's what happened. So they didn't hedge their bet, and they didn't get squeamish, and they didn't get insecure. So I got David Rashi. I got all my casting. I had complete 100% control on that show as a kid starting out. And so it's kind of bizarre that, you know, I never got that again, certainly afterwards. But, you know, when if you try to hedge your bet, if you get nervous, and if you start all of a sudden, what I was hearing was, well, this isn't a traditional comedy. We're starting to make more traditional comedies. And it's like, I always felt that's a mistake, especially when you're not on the radar, when you're lower profile. I think you should go as extreme as possible. But that's just my philosophy, you know?
Probably.
No, look, if you got a low budget show and you're going to get a certain amount of support, not like, you know, ABC gives their new shows a ton of promotion. A network like IFC, they don't have a ton of money. They're not going to be able to. You need to do whatever you can do to stand out. So I think a show like this was perfect for a network like that. This is what I'm not understanding.
It's more of a loss for them because it's more of a loss for them because it worked and people wanted to do a graphic novel and it would have sustained, but, you know, that's just how it is. And, you know, that's fine. They, you know, part of their thing, one of them said to me, well, part of it is the experience of doing it. And part of the experience that was difficult was out of my doing. This is something I came into with a lot of players in place. And, I mean, I could write a book and it would be mind-blowing if I told you some of the stuff that I certainly encountered. But I got it done, and it's no worse for the wear. It came on and it performed well, and people liked the show, and so ultimately, the ends justify the means. But it was a tough thing to do, and also personally, I was going through stuff that was tough. But you know, look, the bottom line of it is, you know, my sympathy also is executives are more insecure than ever because they want to hold on to their jobs. Actually, back then in the ABC era, people knew they had a finite time and they had to try to hit with some things fast. They didn't expect to be there a long time. But now people are trying to hold on to their jobs, and so that's why they've gotten more conservative. But there's been some turnover at ABC. IFC, somebody left, and I don't really know why. So, you know, I'm not here to cast aspersions towards anybody. You know, creating something's like having a child. You know, you do the best that you can, and you raise them, and sometimes they turn out well and you know, make you proud, and other times they go out in the world and, you know, destroy things and blow up buildings, write manifestos. My child does both. So my child is sick and twisted and antichrist, and I'm also proud of it.
Well, you know, and what's funny to me is, too, and IFC is the same network. They're owned by the same network that owns Sundance Channel. And I feel like this show on the Sundance Channel would have done really well, but I feel like it would have been taken care of. I don't know when IFC decided they were going to turn into a more hipster version of Comedy Central.
Comedy Central, where they put shows on and don't support them.
Well, they do support
they do,
these
though.
Shows
they're not
that
bad.
One watches.
But, yeah.
They support
well, you know, this is something you haven't seen before. You know, people are doing shows based on podcasts and things that pre-exist or an extension of a YouTube video. So, you know, but this is something that you know, I was trying to be original. I wasn't doing some 80s spoof, which is what it originally started as. And, you know, I had my perversity about wanting to put violence into it. But, look, the truth of the matter is, I mean, there's some nice people at IFC. They don't have a lot of long-running shows. A lot of their shows just go for one season or maybe two.
Right.
There's not a lot that's running on there for years and years and years, so this became a limited event. I mean, the public wants more, and they still do, but I approached it like it was going to be six, and just that's why I gave it certainly a finale, even though I kept it a little open. But, you know, they were saying, well, hold back. And I said, no, I assume when you give me an order of six, that's all it's ever going to be. That's how I enter things. there's the statement, the power of accurate observation is commonly called cynicism by those who have it. I think it was George Bernard Shaw. I hope it was. But that's how I approached it. I viewed it as going to be like Patrick McGoohan's The Prisoner.
Yeah,
and that's
right.
All it would be.
A hilarious show.
I wanted everyone to know, that it's funny you say that about it, you know, their shows last 1 or 2 years. I can pretty much guarantee you Marin got picked up for a second year, and good for Mark, but the reason you're probably not going to see season 3 is what most people need to understand is a lot of these contracts for actors are for 2 seasons. So let's say IFC has Mark Maron for 2 seasons, which is probably what the deal is, and they got him real cheap. The next time, I don't care what network you're on, Maron's lawyers are going to try to negotiate like a really good deal. And these kind of networks just don't have the money for it either. So that's another reason why you see a lot of 1 or 2 season shows on IMC.
Well, right. Plus with the changing nature of what Alan talked about, where these talents are coming from. I mean, these jackasses with their podcasts who think they can break into the business. Wait a second.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No one here. No one here. Not on this show.
Well, you know, that was what was fascinating, part of the problem I was having with them when it was all done. And they also had a regime change in there, too. They started talking about their brand. They said, this looks like a movie. This doesn't look like a TV show. It looks like a movie. It doesn't look like the other comedies. And I thought, that should be a plus. They said, it doesn't look like our other shows. And I said, well, yeah, it's in focus. You know what I mean? And so that's part of the reason that they, you know, they're giving a million different excuses why they aired it the way they did. But they said, we're airing it like a movie with movies because it looks like a movie. So it's you know, it's hard when you're dealing with an amorphous entity that doesn't really have an identity and you got insecure people and they're swinging at, you know, trying to stick with things and things they're comfortable with. But, you know, I have nothing really bad to say, you know, about them because, it wound up working.
You got your show made.
Shout Factory is how you do it. Shout Factory are great partners.
And they see Shout Factory loves comedians, but they truly get how to market comedy and comedians, and they know it's about
the
material.
Which is very hard, very hard. The hardest thing to market.
But here's the difference between Shout Factory and IFC. Shout Factory recognizes the material, not the names. They recognize a good show. They recognize a brand. They recognize those kind of things. IFC is like, okay, let's do a bunch of sketch shows. We'll bring in Will Ferrell. We'll bring in all these people. We'll bring in all
the usual
stuff, Paul Rudd, whatever. They'll be on for 3 minutes. And for some reason, they think that that's going to draw viewers into their network. And it does, but it's such a small incremental number. Like, I don't know. I don't get the philosophy behind it. But okay, all right. Alan says, let sleeping dogs lie. Fine. Okay.
Well, no, they're just trying to survive and get anybody to watch. But look, I think you're making a mistake when you say a network. You're calling a network. A network is an entity that airs programming. Original programming around the clock, sometimes
that's
7
true.
Nights a week.
That's true.
So when you deal with a small little cable channel that shows, you know, and it's a little schizophrenic, it shows Malcolm in the Middle leading into, a Geary Wrath of God.
Right.
So, you know, and it only programs a half hour or an hour of original programming every few months. That's not a network to me.
I think my favorite thing was leading into Alan's series Bullet in the Face, which you can get now on Amazon, iTunes, Shout Factory is the one.
Shout Factory is the best place to buy it. Yes, Shout Factory. They're great. No, I know it's on Amazon. There's a digital download, but you want to buy the DVD. That's what I
right. You want to buy the whole set, especially for the director commentaries. But the point I was going to make is I loved when Bullet in the Face premiered because the lead-in, at least for night one, was like, I think it was Rambo 4, and they showed it twice in a row. I'm not even kidding.
I love that.
And I go, well, this is fascinating. You get one of the premier, like, independent creative comedy minds in show business, like Alan Spencer. You get his new show, which is this dark, funny, fucking brutal show, and then you're like, you know what we'll pair it up with?
Coming up after Rambo 4.
Rape. Brutality.
From the mind of Alan Spencer.
No, but
well,
I mean,
you know, yeah, like, I mean, that was appropriate. Stallone and myself, I have a bond with Stallone. But look, you know, the thing is, the other thing that, you know, if this were done for another network or a traditional network like Fox or something like that, first of all, they wouldn't have made it. first, or if they made it be an unsold pilot, it'd be something you may be fun on YouTube. So despite all the, you know, all the journalists, I didn't say anything about the airing pattern. All the journalists were the ones, the critics were saying it didn't make sense why they aired it like this, why they'd aired it over two nights. Certainly people are, the DVD reviewers are criticizing the network because they hadn't heard of the show and they love it. But, you know, my attitude is they didn't have to air it, but they did. And it exists.
Yeah.
And it's on DVD and it's there in the canon. So I just don't go around, you know, I don't feel a need to bash as much as just promote what's there. And also, but when you have somebody like Shout Factor, I'm doing extra interviews because that's the way to do it. I mean, they embrace it and they back it 100%. They give me free Blu-rays of Vincent Price movies like Dr. Fives. And
that's awesome.
So they take care of you. But no, what I want to get out there, because I do, in defense of you and IFC, I think this is the fair thing to say about the whole thing. I think this is how you sum this all up, is, look, there's a lot of people that never get their shows made. Alan Spencer's now had two series made. And that this series got a green light and got made no matter what the price was, and they aired it. God bless. That's great. Thank you for IFC for that. And you know, and you have to give it to IFC, too, for at least keeping their promise that they were going to make the show and for taking a chance on it. Because
And I've actually had three series. There was a short-lived one I co-created with Mel Brooks at Shout Factory investigating whether they can, get the rights to. But, you know, as far as the other thing, it's when you talk about difficult and things like that, and some of, there's a generational thing that goes on with me because, you know, I look like I'm kind of relatively young or I'm a certain middle age, but I've been in the business long.
You've always looked 45, Alan. You're like friend Lenny Cannata, who's looked 45 since he was 17. Yes.
Well, thank you. You know, but when you're, but when you talk about this stuff, you know, when you've been doing things for a long, long time, you know, when you start as 15, and you have kind of a breadth of knowledge there against other people that are neophytes or new or not as much, you know, it becomes kind of funny. I mean, you deal with that. You know, when you reference a MacGuffin, that was funny for me when I said, well, this is a MacGuffin. When I was explaining something, somebody was giving a note that didn't make any sense, and I said, well, that's a MacGuffin. They didn't know what it was, and so I had to explain what a MacGuffin was. They thought it was McDonald's.
Oh, God.
And you know, you talk about Hitchcock, you talk about Psycho. You talk about the movie Psycho. I started talking about the movie Psycho, and the person says, I didn't care for it. They go, you didn't like Psycho? And they said, yeah, because it kind of dragged after Anne Heche died.
Oh!
Yeah, right. Oh, man.
The remake.
I can't believe people said that.
Well, yeah, so I'm dealing with that. I mean, I spent 3 hours trying to figure out how to edit something based on the note, and they used the wrong technical term. And so, I mean, it's like, you know, so you try to be patient and jovial and everything like that. But, you know, the bottom line of it is, you know, nobody really cares about the process. They care about the result, and well, usually they do. So, you know, you can be easygoing and patient and everything like that and do crap, and that's fine, but or you can – you can fight for what you believe and try to hold to some things and do the best you can. You always try to be reasonable, but there's some things that, look, I mean, Sledgehammer wouldn't be there today if my agent at the time said, go with the suggestions for the casting. What are you doing? You've never done anything, and you're speaking up to these executives. But I knew in my heart of hearts, the thing would stink. I wanted David Rashi. The world didn't know who he was, but I think I was proven right. You know?
Yeah, you were proven right.
That's so weird about the process.
By the way, for our listeners who may not know MacGuffin, I guess the best way to explain it is when you read movie reviews and the idiot critic says, and this goes on with the character which lends nothing to the plot, that's pretty much a MacGuffin. But what the critic doesn't understand is it adds to the motivation for the characters.
Right.
I read that all the time. I love reading reviews where it's like, and this scene happens, but nothing happens. That's usually the MacGuffin.
Right.
That's usually where it
happens.
There's
also a thing called emotional continuity, which is different from narrative continuity.
Right. Right.
I know.
Well, listen, but you know what I feel the need to say, because you guys, I want to be fair about this. Now, I want to, and hear me out, and I want to hear your opinion of this, because I know that both of you are fair people. I obviously know one of you more than the other, but this show was called Bulls in Space. It featured graphic violence. For TV, for basic cable, for a comedy, it was unusual. In fact, the PTC, this parent-teachers group. It was the only comedy listed about violent programs on TV. I think we were number two behind Walking Dead.
Awesome.
Which I was proud of, that a half hour, that shows that comedy can hold its own with drama.
15 hours to beat you. So you probably, on average, were better than them with violence.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they don't care if it's comic violence, if the joke is shooting 10 people. They're just counting them up. I mean, that happened on Sledgehammer. We had two people get killed, and Taco Bell bailed as a sponsor because we had two people really get killed, and they were upset. And I said, well, how many people has Taco Bell killed? You know, I was young and honorary then. I mean, I was just, I didn't care, but now I care a little bit more. But to the credit about the insecurity and what they did as far as that get it over quick airing, you know, a few weeks before we aired, the Colorado movie theater shooting happened. And, you know, certainly on Twitter, I saw people attacking them, and I intervened in a couple of instances because a few of them were high-profile going, and you're running commercials for something called Bullet in the Face, and you're showing, you know, heads, you know, cut off and things like that. The show business puts its tail between their legs. And by the way, I mean, I'm going to reveal something I haven't said before. You know, I got a call from the network, and they told me they were saying, that was the exact quote, we're calling with our tail between our legs about, you know, the show, before they aired it, when they explained to me how they're going to air it. But unfortunately, it was justified by current events because, you know, show business is very craven. I mean, they'll make millions of dollars off movies and TV shows featuring reams of violence, but anytime there's a headline, all of a sudden they turn into Gandhi. You know, anytime there's a real shooting, all of a sudden, we're going to change our ways. We're going to calm it down. The Gangster Squad, if you remember, is a movie that ended with a massacre in a movie theater.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, you know, the Frugal Movie Studio is spending a fortune to change that ending and reshoot it because they don't want a shooting in a theater. And I remember thinking, well, what are you going to do with Lincoln? You know? So to their credit, I'm going to say to the credit of the insecurity. Now, you know, that's where some of the fears came in. But, you know, I wound up addressing it because I've had a lot of time to think about this stuff because I don't believe that any movie, I don't believe Clockwork Orange, I don't believe The Wild Bunch, I don't believe Dirty Harry, has ever caused a violent act. If you're going to do violence, I mean, you could open up Cat in the Hat, and that could provoke you. There's nothing a TV show can do, but all a TV show can do is if it's in the wrong place at the right time, and that applies to movies too, it can become a vortex.
Right.
And then there's a spotlight on the network, and you know they didn't want that. Is my feeling. You have a little gentle, you know, sketch show about Oregon or Portland, and you're doing well with that. You don't want to open up this sea of trouble. But you know the cool thing about the way they aired it is the Expendables 2 was one of the big sponsors, so that worked really well for me. But you know, that's where the fear comes from, and I'm not endorsing it. I'm just saying that I can understand it. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, especially with all the – once again, it goes back to what we talked about, like, first 5 minutes of the interview. All these networks, small, big, whatever, they're all owned by corporations. And what really makes people money is advertising. That's what does it. I mean, DVD sales, all that crap, doesn't really mean anything when it comes down to it. Advertising's the almighty dollar. So, I mean, they kind of have to go with whatever the flow is. That's why MSNBC's firing all their hosts left and right for talking shit about Republicans because, you know, they're like, well, that's offensive and we can't have you on here.
Right.
Our advertisers don't like offensive.
Right. Well, it's true. It's just all bad timing. That's all it is. And there's nothing really you can do about it. I do agree. Yeah, you can't hold entertainment responsible for how people might behave.
Yeah.
Because that's a dangerous thing to do.
There's one thing I hold entertainment responsible for how people behave. I've thought about this long and hard. I'm like, okay, I don't think violence. And I don't – because, for instance, how many people watch Duck Dynasty? You don't see people moving to the boons to, like, go capture ducks or doing whatever the fuck they're doing. But what you do see is how many people want to be reality TV stars now?
Right.
How many? I mean, like, literally everyone I meet wants to be on a reality show.
Yeah, but those people were not terribly bright to begin with, though.
No, and I agree with that. Now, then you could also say maybe it's not terribly bright people to begin with to see the violence on TV.
Right.
I don't necessarily equate the two there, but what I do equate the two with is bigger things like laziness and shit like
in
that.
In my opinion, ideas are always more subversive than acts,
yeah.
Depicting acts. People always get up in arms about the Grand Theft Auto games.
Sure.
Where you can kill people and, you know, cut cops up and do anything. Mm-hmm. But none of those people are offended by the fact that those games depict society as a joke.
Right.
As a shithole. You know, and that, you know, it's a real breeding ground for defeatist cynicism. That doesn't get mentioned.
Alan, let me ask you about reality TV. How do you feel about the fact that there's so many people now in America that just want to be reality stars?
Well, what's interesting is, believe it or not, I started having discussions about doing an unscripted show.
Mm-hmm. We won't give away details, but why? What was your feeling that you wanted to do unscripted? And how would you do it differently than what's been going on right now, where we're not, you're not like putting the Kardashians on a pedestal?
I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. I mean, it made me laugh because they broached the idea of me, like, hosting or doing something within it, because I do this thing called Trailers from Hell for Joe Dodger's website, where people have seen me on that, along with some good people like Josh Olson, who wrote A History of Violence when we're speaking of violence, and other quality filmmakers and things like that. So, you know, to me, what appealed to me is also because doing something different, certainly about, and I would do it with my skew, is, to me, it's a little bit easier. The people that I spoke to initially were really, really cool, and they're some of the best. They have one of the top shows ever, and it's a quality show. It's not Duck Dynasty or anything. Their shows have some integrity. So,
right.
But what's interesting is that, you know, the thing is, I think about there are two things about the proliferation of reality. They tend to be cheaper to do, and so that always is going to appeal to the bureaucracy of show business. But when you think about it, a lot of the problems of show business come through semantic problems, miscommunication, and interpretation, because people will read a script, and once you shoot a script, the script is done. It's the footage you have. And then you have to let the script go, and then you have to edit that. But, you know, a lot of times people visualize things differently, or they don't know certainly what it is. It happened on Bold in the Face. The scripts were very different than what we shot as far as a tone. But it still worked, and I was navigating throughout it and got something that worked from it. But they were very, very different. But you know, I think from the reality and kind of capturing what's there and skewing it, it isn't as up for as much misinterpretation because you're just dealing with, quote-unquote, even though anything that is filmed like that you can't call reality, but it's kind of like what you shoot is what you got. And so the expectation, I think, is different going into it as opposed to reading a script and then saying, well, he didn't deliver that line right or that casting didn't work and things like that. So I think that's fascinating to me. And certainly, you know, the way Sacha Baron Cohen did it, that's what interests me.
If you were going to make a show, though, about people just living their lives, let's say you were going to make a show like the style of Kardashians, where really nothing happens except these sitcom-like plots that go on with this family, what is a better way to do it than the way they're doing it? What is a better way to showcase real people in their real lives than the Kardashians?
I can't answer it yet because I haven't gone towards it, and that show works for some people. What would interest me is, see, what I think to me what a reality show should be is what if you did the Twilight Zone as reality? What if you took a person and put them in this environment and
right.
not just do punked or Scare Factor or things like that, and really worked on them psychologically and got something like that coming out of that. That's interesting to me. Think about William Shatner in On the Plane and that classic Twilight Zone. Now, what if you were really a guy in a plane and you managed to rig that or do that? I think the reactions to that could technically maybe play the same as what happened in the Twilight Zone. And that's
right.
Interesting. That kind of thing interests me. I like going for the psychological kind of aspect of it. And also, you know, reality for its survival, or unscripted, as they call it, that has to change too, because, you know, people get tired of it after a while. So you have to throw, you know, the British are very good. The foreign markets are very good. They're always buying things from the other markets and doing them here in America that they do. So, I mean, I think there's a, I think that the, in the UK there's a show, a kind of a game show that's a real-life horror show, putting people in really dangerous, kind of the most dangerous game situation. So
right.
Anything where there's a real element. I like Jeopardy. I like things with danger and jeopardy certainly about them. And I'm a big fan of Jackass, too, by the way. You know,
yeah,
I mean, I thought that was high art. So you approach it. You know, look, you know, the reason I don't care for the reality shows that you were talking about is I don't care about those people. I don't like seeing them. I don't the Kardashians, what they're famous for is ridiculous to me. And you know, the Duck Dynasty, I'm not, you know, there's an audience for people that like to watch inbreeding, but that's not me. So I got my fill from Deliverance, you know. I mean, so
Let me ask you before we let you go, Alan. I wanted to ask you about you were talking about doing things on lower budgets and how you get things done. Hex got your budget cut in half.
I'm going to tell you one thing too. I want to give you this before you hold that question. This is my original concept, by the way, for Bold in the Face. Just so you'll know, and I was brought in to retool something that they had and didn't work and everything. What I originally wanted to do with it, I wasn't going to put my name on it. What I was going to do was we're going to say that this was a show from Germany and then it was relooped, and it was relooped for the American audience. It was a German show that we'd imported, and it turned out unintentionally funny. So that's what I was going to do. But they wanted my name on it, and then we got stars and everything. But originally I wanted to say it was an import. It was an imported show, make a fake foreign show that was unintentionally funny, so almost like some sort of Ed Wood thing. That's what I wanted to do. So that's how bizarre out I was trying to do it originally. So
that's what I love about Alan, though. He always has these ideas that haven't been done before, but I don't think anyone would ever give him the money to do.
They did. We were going to do that, but then ultimately said, well, we want your name on it. We want to create a sledgehammer, and then if you get recognizable stars, it all went away. But that was the original intent. But anyhow, you were asking me about doing things on low budget. So.
Well, no, because we're doing this film now, and I wanted to see if you had any advice for directing, especially directing something on a low budget. Or running a production on a low budget. Any tips?
First, you should wear comfortable shoes because you're going to be standing a lot. You should do that on any production because you got to keep your energy up and everything like that. The problem, I think it was H.G. Wells. I'm going to paraphrase H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells says he said something like, all that matters is what you do with what you've got. He said something like that. We can look it up later, but all that matters is what you do with what you have. I think that's what he had said.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't try to be overtly ambitious and in the sense of trying for things that you can't realize on a budget and that won't look good. You know, simple can often just take care of itself. You know, the original Rocky was made for a low budget. Nobody watches that and thinks of that as a low budget movie.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
You know, and more money was hurled at the sequels, but did they make them any better? No. And the only sequel that, I mean, I enjoy them all for various reasons, so they get into kitsch, but the only one that's a legitimate heir to the original Rocky is the last one, you know, Rocky Balboa,
right.
Which once again was a low budget. And so that's the bookend for me. A lot of times artists get more money and they don't get more creativity from it. A lot of the time when they're challenged and have a lower budget, they get more creative.
Right.
You know, the first Star Trek, the motion picture, the first Star Trek movie that Paramount made, you know, was bloated and was heavy special effects and they're very slow and everything. And then the Wrath of Khan was done on a television budget at the time, much more pared down. That's the better movie to everybody. But,
yeah, the story's better. They did more with story is why I think that's the big key.
Yeah, but, you know, as somebody said about a musical, if everything isn't working, you know, if the music isn't good, they said people don't come out whistling the sets. So I think it's you have to look at what you have, and that's what I've always done. I'm not the person that, you know, what I did on the Bullet in the Face was, okay, here's our budget, that's all it is. I didn't ask for any more. I was always dealing with what I was given. I wasn't coming back later going, I need more money for this, I need more money from that. I was always dealing within the parameters of what I was given, and that's always been my MO. I think that's part of my longevity, though, by the way, because creativity is always going to be nebulous and misunderstood by people. They understand bottom line. And I always felt on Sledgehammer that I had so much creative freedom because I was fiscally responsible.
Right.
So they didn't care how nuts it was. You know, I'm blowing up the world with a nuclear device. But, you know, I was on budget that week. And so, you know, we didn't have a lot of overtime. So it's like, oh, that's fine. So, on the Bullet in the Face, that was my approach. I didn't go in there saying, in fact, I pulled a day out of the schedule for budget reasons. I would say we should take a day out. And then we wound up putting it back in. And I was cutting things while we were shooting and changing things and rewriting. I talk about it on the DVD commentary about something where I had to think on my feet. I wasn't clinging to things. And, in fact, I remember telling the director once, he said, we needed 2 more weeks of prep. And I said, yeah, but we don't have them.
Yeah.
And that's how you approach it. And also, you know what I felt? If you get somebody two more weeks, it's not going to make any difference. They'll just want another 2 more weeks. I mean, there's something called the paralysis, the paralysis of analysis. And I think Clint Eastwood was the one talking about that. You know, Clint Eastwood is confident enough, you know, that, you know, he always wraps on time or under schedule on budget. But, you know, it's confidence about knowing what you got and knowing what you're.
You know what? And I'm going to let you go with this.
Your exteriors have to become interiors.
No, this is fascinating because Alan keeps bringing up stuff. All right. Let's end it on this. How much of being successful in Hollywood has to do with confidence, Alan?
I think it's all of it.
I agree. I think so, too. I think that's, like, the most important lesson. Because something I've learned doing this film, and because doing this film, I got to research and meet so many people in life. I've never met so many people in my life till the last, like, 5 months, is there is a lack of confidence in so many people you would think would have great confidence, or you would think would have some confidence, and they lack any at all. And then you realize why they're doing what they're doing with their lives, or they're not breaking that glass ceiling, or whatever the case may be, is their confidence levels are really low. And I feel like, oh man, if people had this wicked confidence, they'd be getting whatever they want done. I do agree. I think confidence is a big, big factor.
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, there's a look, you know, is there anybody that comes off more confident than Mel Brooks?
No, he just does what he does, and he knows he's doing it, and he doesn't doubt himself, doesn't feel shitty about anything. He's just Mel Brooks.
He knows what he thinks is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. And that's what Marty Feldman said about Mel, I mean, which was fascinating. He said he would give him something to do that maybe he didn't think was funny, and he said he would never in a million years bet against him. Because he said he knows what's funny. He would never bet against him. He would go along with it because he says that man knows what's funny.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. Bullet in the Face, get it from Shout Factory. You can go on the internet and do that, shoutfactory.com, I believe. And then is there anything else you need to promote, Alan, or is Bullet in the Face all we got today?
No, that's all I'm promoting here. I'm still figuring what I'm going to do next. But like I said, I'm having some interesting discussions.
Well, let me know what you're going to do next. We love talking about it.
And by the way, part of the reason I'm having these interesting discussions is because people really liked Bullet in the Face. They loved that it was different. So I have IFC to thank for that, don't I?
Yes, great. You do. Thank you so much, Alan. And let's talk soon.
All right.
Thanks, Alan.
Pal.
Bye.
All right. That was Alan Spencer. Always, he's so smart.
He's bright, right? He teaches you so much about television and the history of television and the business
he's
of television.
Wicked smart. That guy's like a walking encyclopedia.
He fucking quotes George Bernard Shaw and Shakespeare
right.
and H.G. Wells.
Right. And Don Adams. All in like one breath.
Yeah.
Do you got anything you got to talk about before we go? I'm ready to wrap up. Anthony walked in, looked in his fucking shorts. Half-shaved legs. What's going on with that? I don't even want to know. He has like a quarter of a shaved leg.
I know, with a bandage on it.
Anthony,
his shorts match your trainer.
Why don't you two talk? When I come back from taking a pee, I'll close out. But listen,
the ladies
Anthony,
love it.
That's all you
that's
had.
That's it. That's
it?
All he has. That's Anthony Giuliano, one of the producers of this film, everybody.
Okay.
You just heard him.
I'm going to go shower. I'm either going to go to the gym or go to bed. I don't know.
I'll be at Cigars and Stripes now, actually.
Yeah. Anything else going on that we need to bring up?
Things are simmering. I'll let you know.
Okay.
I got some things on the rise, but I'm not going to talk about them just yet for all the people listening.
Well, I hate life a little less after that, so I mean.
Yeah, come on.
You know.
Cheer up. Yeah. Alan, think about all the negative shit Alan could say about the TV business. And he really doesn't throw anyone under the bus. He's very classy.
He's diplomatic.
He's diplomatic.
On the air.
There's a difference. No, I'm sure
off the air he's a diplomat, too. He's just a gentleman, that Alan Spencer.
Yeah. Fuck.
I need to learn how to do that.
Do.
I need to be diplomatic like Ron Zimmerman and Alan Spencer.
A little more like Alan.
Ron's
okay.
Not so diplomatic.
Yeah, he's diplomatic.
Can
he's
you
just...
see why the two of them are friends, though? You totally
I
get
see
it.
Why, yes.
Yeah, you totally get it. That, those two are like history teachers that felt like, I don't know, they're in the wrong business. They
right.
should both be history majors.
Do they both just talk at once when they hang out and oh. neither one is listening to the other one?
Oh, that'd be the best
it,
Joe
like,
Swanberg movie ever.
Yeah. Like
a
both,
lot of overlapping dialogue
like,
with
you know
no
when,
one listening
when
to
you
anybody.
Go to a play and you see bad extras and they're both pantomiming and talking at the same time, like in the back they're supposed
yeah.
to be miming. That's what – do they do that, but it's real
I
talking?
Think so. No, I think we just summed up every Joe Swanberg movie ever. I think that we just summed up the mumblecore movie.
Joe's got a new one coming
overlapping
out.
Dialogue
yeah.
with no one, no character really listening to the other character.
Right.
That is every fucking Swanberg movie.
Yeah.
When I think about it.
And episodes of this show when all your friends are on.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, that's mumblecore.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear his new movie's good. Happy Christmas at Sundance. I heard it did well.
Yeah.
I heard it got... I read the reviews. It did good.
Yeah.
You know, he put his son in and like, he's going to be that guy.
He's gonna
I love
be that
you,
guy,
Joe,
yeah.
but you're going to be
even
that
Joe
guy.
Even Joe Swanberg
put your whole
does
family
that.
In and, you know, yeah. It, right. No, his son's like one of the stars of the movie.
Really?
Yeah, he's two.
Two, okay.
He's like, before this looks like legit nepotism,
okay.
let's just put
are there
him
a lot
in
of sex
two.
Scenes in this one, too? I
no,
know Joe
I
likes
don't think
sex
there
scenes.
Are any.
I don't think
Dunham.
That's tasteful
it's
at
Lena
all.
Lena Dunham, and you could see that every week on her show.
Oh.
And
Anna right.
Kendrick, who doesn't get naked.
Yeah,
so.
Right. No.
Yeah, she doesn't get naked. I know that.
Okay.
Anthony's done his CNDB,
you know,
his skin, Mr. Skin.
You know, there's been a real pervert void in the shape of Alex Luisi lately on this show, but Anthony is filling it nicely.
I love how Anthony and Alex have this friction between the two of them when really
they're
the
same
level pervert.
Same fucking guy.
Yeah, well, no, well. There's some differences, but on the pervert level, same guy, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. All right, we'll see you next Wednesday. Thanks for listening. Alan Spencer, Shout Factory, Bullet in the Face. Give it an order.
See you next Wednesday from the John Landis film.